Welcome to this week's edition of the Third Opinion Podcast. This week, part one of an interview with the author of Zionism and the Black Church, and we'll discuss Donald Trump's recent comments about American Jews. Remember to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Here's this week's Third Opinion.
Good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, whenever you're listening to this. This is the Third Opinion Podcast, and on WKDW Radio, two Jews, three opinions. I'm one of the two Jews, Mike Deason.
I'm the other, Lorene Jaffe.
How you doing today, Lorene?
I'm good. You know, we got a Bucks game tonight, so, you know, Tampa Bay Bucks fan, so excited about that. But by the time y'all are hearing this, the game will already be over, so I'm hoping that we beat the New Orleans Saints. I'm sorry if you're a Saints fan, but here in Tampa, we gotta root for the home team.
That's right. Well, as you know, I've been a season ticket holder for years. I think I started going to the games when my 37-year-old son was 9. So, you know, I'm not a fair weather fan, but anyhow.
No, you're not. I applaud you for that.
Yes.
There are plenty of those in town.
Been there through good, bad, and ugly, and there were there were some ugly. Hey, there's a story that you and I were talking about right before we started this podcast. It upset us both. We told you last week about an attorney. She's from San Francisco, isn't she?
She is. She's a civil rights attorney that works for the organization CARE, Council for American Islamic Relations, in San Francisco. Her name is Zahra Billow, and we played a clip from her speech last week. It was a speech she gave in Chicago. It was the Muslim American activist group that supports Palestine. They were in there. There's this huge organization. They had a huge meeting in Chicago, and she spoke there and pretty much, you know, called mainstream U.S. synagogues, on-campus Hillels, the Anti-Defamation League, etc., pretty much called the majority of the Jewish world in the United States of America enemies.
Absolutely. No question about it. No question about it. And then CARE, the organization, comes to her defense. And, you know,
wildly comes to her defense, like in a crazy way, Mike, right? Like, you know, in the past, it was nuanced. In the past, they would be nuanced about their open anti-Semitism. But now they just come right out and say, and they're like, well, she was only targeting synagogues and Jewish groups that support, quote, the continuation of the Jewish state. and they said, and then they go on to say the group said Billow was in favor of fringe Jewish organizations that oppose Israel's existence. So in essence, they came. CARE has pretty much come out and acknowledged that they support the end of Israel, that they support the destruction of the only Jewish state in the world where over 50% of the world's Jews live. Like we support its destruction and end. So we're singling out Israel, you know, to be completely destroyed. I mean that says it all there, folks.
Yeah,
so
people say to us, why do you guys badmouth CARE? Well, they've been labeled a terrorist organization, you have to realize. Jonathan Greenblatt, who we'll hear from a little bit later on, head of the ADL, just blasted this and blasted CARE for, you know, they put on this allure of being a peaceful, friendly organization, just trying to help people who are Islamic, and they want better relations, they say, with the rest of the world. That's a lie. That is a lie. It is such a lie. And that really upset me this week. First off, that she said that thing. But secondly, they come rushing to her aid and say, yep, she's right.
Unbelievable. It was unbelievable. So that was a follow from last week. And then I think, you know, my favorite story of the week, though, you know, we mentioned Miss Universe. Yeah. So I'd like to congratulate Miss India, who was crowned Miss Universe. And her name is Hana Sandhu. But there's this lovely article in Haaretz, you know, in essence, that Israel was truly the winner in the whole thing. I mean, when you think about, I think they said almost 171 different countries. People were like, I think it was like 600 million people in 171 countries were watching you know, the Miss Universe pageant and watching the contestants go all around Israel, having a wonderful time from the Dead Sea to Jerusalem to everywhere. And they were all tweeting on social media and their photos. And it was just really just such an amazing PR event, really, for Israel to be seen in such a positive light.
Yeah, Israel, you are right. Israel was the big winner. And while there are some people who said they were going to boycott it, it came off perfectly. So congratulations to Miss India, now Miss World, or Miss Universe, and to Israel for doing that so well. There were some other disturbing things, though, this week. One of them was Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky, who thinks he's smarter than Dr. Fauci. Those two hate each other. But he once again blocked funding for the Iron Dome. Now, the Iron Dome is so important for Israel. It helps protect Israeli citizens and anybody who's in Israel from rocket and bomb attacks that are coming from Hamas or from wherever, and it saves lives. And the United States helps fund it because it saves lives.
It's so aggravating. It really is aggravating. I mean, I get Rand Paul.
I don't get Rand Paul at all.
But he's a libertarian. He pretty much votes the same way all the time.
Right, he does. He is consistent.
To him, it's like he just doesn't believe that we should be paying foreign aid to another country. I mean, that's pretty much his thing. He always votes the same way. It's just, you know, if you live in his district, I would encourage you to write to him, to call his office, to indicate to him that it's very important to you that he supports, you know, Iron Dome.
It's going to eventually
hear from his constituents.
It will be funded. There will be an omnibus bill that it will be included in, but they need the money now. And so it just delays the ability to continue to work with the Iron Dome to protect people in Israel from attacks. It's not an aggressive weapon or anything. It's a protector.
It's an offensive, right? That's right.
Right.
No, offensive. It saves lives. Exactly.
Yeah. It's
Iron
defensive.
Dome saves lives. And I, you know, and going to saving lives. I mean, you know, look. This is why do we need this? I don't know, because Tehran decided to put on the front page of the Tehran Times this week, you know, a map of Israel with rocket strikes literally covering all of Israel, you know, pretty much warning Israel. One wrong move, it said, you know, and they're pretty much going to wipe Israel out, which we know there's like something like 150,000 sophisticated rockets, and they're working on missile technology right now in Lebanon. These are all in the Lebanon-Israeli border that Hezbollah has, which is funded by Iran, you know, targeting, you know, key cities all throughout Israel. I mean, without the Iron Dome, Israel would be completely, completely defenseless against this type of attack.
Absolutely.
So it was a very aggressive move by Iran to put that on in their newspaper this week. They're a bully. That's what they do.
But fortunately, the Iron Dome helps protect Israel. One of the things that I thought was interesting this week, and you and I disagree on this, is that a bunch of high-ranking officials have said that they thought that pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal was detrimental to Israel, including the former head of Mossad, the former defense minister, Moshe Ya'alon. They say that they think it makes Israel less safe because when the U.S. pulled out, Iran was able to go ahead and increase their nuclear capability that wouldn't have been allowed under the JCPOA, now they're closer to a nuclear weapon than they would have been had that treaty been in effect. Go ahead, your turn, because I know you disagree.
I do disagree, but I think there's a lot of debate. Obviously, Benny Gantz strongly supported getting out of the JCPOA. He thought it was a bad deal again because it didn't involve the nations that are mostly impacted. Right, it involved Israel, Saudi Arabia, or any of the other Gulf states, the ones that are, you know, the neighbors to Iran that are under threat. And we also know it really had no enforcement, had no bite, because the IAEA inspectors, you know, were not allowed access to certain sites. The cameras were shut down. You had to give like 30-day notice to Iran, and Iran would then consider whether or not to give them permission to certain sites, of which they could clean up and do a bunch of things in the meantime. I mean, there it lacked a lot of bite when it came to oversight to ensure, you know, that they weren't moving forward on their very open plan.
There were holes. Listen, there were holes in the plan. I will agree 100%, particularly the inspections. But Iran is in a stronger position to get closer to having a nuclear weapon now than they were when that treaty was in effect. And that really concerns me.
Maybe. You know, I mean, I think we all wanted a bigger and better deal. And I think, you know, that's obviously what Trump was trying to go for. He was trying to put increased pressure, bigger, better deal, put pressure on with sanctions, force him to come back to the table under our terms. You know, I don't know that they're feeling the pressure right now. We've actually lifted some sanctions. Iran's getting money now from China for oil. There's, you know, so they're getting an influx of cash. I wonder, I think it was $50 billion.
It's some ridiculous amount.
And
I have concern with China and Iran.
Yeah. Like just in like the last couple of weeks, it was like $50 billion. From China. It was a lot of money. It's a problem, right? China's a little trouble.
I'm worried. I'm very concerned about China aligning itself with Iran. That is very problematic. But you brought up the former president Donald Trump, who I don't like Trump. I'll be the first to admit. I'm being very, very candid about that. But it seems to me in the past couple of weeks, he's gone off the deep end. And he did an interview and talked about Jews not loving Israel. According to Jonathan Greenblatt, again, the head of the ADL, it was filled with anti-Semitic tropes. I don't know what he was thinking. His daughter is Jewish. His grandkids are Jewish from Jared Kushner and all that stuff. But He really leveled Jews. Let's take a listen. This is Jonathan Greenblatt with Jake Tapper from CNN.
In an interview with Israeli journalist Barak Ravid, Trump claimed, falsely, that Jewish Americans do not like or care about Israel, and he spouted off a number of other rather ignorant remarks about Jews. Let's get right to what the former president said with Jonathan Greenblatt of the Anti-Defamation League. Jonathan, before we discuss Trump's comments, trigger alert for people who don't like anti-Semitism. Let's play them.
People in this country that are Jewish no longer love Israel. I'll tell you, the evangelical Christians love Israel more than the Jews in this country. It used to be that Israel had absolute power over Congress, and today I think it's the exact opposite. When you look at the New York Times, the New York Times hates Israel, hates them. And they're Jewish people that run the New York Times.
So a lot to dive into there. I mean, that's like four or five anti-Semitic tropes in 40 seconds. A new record, perhaps. Let's look at Trump's first claim, John. A Pew survey earlier this year found that 58% of Jews in America are very or somewhat emotionally attached to Israel. 60% say that they have a lot or something in common with Israeli Jews. So to say that American Jews don't like or love Israel, that's inaccurate just as a factual matter.
Yeah, look, I mean, Jake, these comments, unfortunately, are not very surprising from former President Trump, but they fall somewhere between stunning and stupid. Now, I expect this from people on the extreme right or the far left, but you would think a former president of the United States with Jewish grandchildren would get stuff like this right. And what are we talking about? Look, the bottom line is Jews, he is not the one to tell Jewish people about their feelings for Israel, but there is widespread, overwhelming positive feelings among the Jewish community for the Jewish state. And that's just the start, as you pointed out, of what he said, tropes about greed, power, loyalty, clannishness, like literally you wonder how low he's going to go.
Yeah, and then he said Israel, I'm just going to quote this, Israel had absolute power over Congress, and today I think it's the exact opposite. I mean, the idea that Israel had absolute control over Congress or absolute power over Congress, that's the kind of anti-Semitism you hear from like members of the Klan.
That's right. I mean, this sounds like Richard Spencer, or this sounds like some of the most radical people on the left, or Lyndon LaRouche, for goodness sakes. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. Israel doesn't have absolute power over anything, even its own electorate, for goodness sakes. But this plays into these longstanding tropes, Jake, that have led to Jewish people being harassed, suffering from violence, and literally being killed. So it's not something we can take lightly, especially when it's coming from a former commander-in-chief. It's really quite disturbing.
Trump claimed that evangelical Christians love Israel more than Jewish Americans. This is a complicated issue. Obviously, a lot of evangelical Christians are supportive of Israel. There's a theological reason behind a lot of that. What's he talking about here?
Well, look, it's certainly true that there are many people of the Christian faith, evangelicals, Catholics, other denominations within Protestantism, the Church of Latter-day Saints, that feel very strongly about the Jewish state of Israel. That could be for biblical reasons or political reasons or personal reasons. But to say that this group loves Israel more than that group, like, that's the kind of analysis we don't really need, because at the bottom line, Jake, it's anti-Semitism to play into these tropes and these myths about who feels more strongly about the Jewish state helps no one, particularly the Jewish people.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a contest, right? I mean, he seems to be judging,
right.
The way he seems to look at this is, like, support for Israel is measured by how much people voted for me, for Donald Trump. Evangelical Christians overwhelmingly voted for me, therefore they love Israel more than Jewish Americans who disproportionately did not vote for me.
Yeah, look, the bottom line is President Trump's yardstick, as always, is his ego, because that's what seems to be the measure that he uses to determine someone's value, someone's patriotism, or in this case, someone's Zionism. But none of it works. And again, we have seen time and again, whether it's, you know, people who belong to different organizations or extremist movements employ the same kind of myths, Jake, and use it to justify the marginalization and the persecution of Jewish people.
Yeah.
And it's flat out wrong.
And then, of course, he went after the New York Times, claiming the newspaper hates Israel and it's run by Jews. Obviously, he goes on to say he's talking about the Sulzberger families who have run the paper for decades. But still, to say the New York Times is run, he goes, Jewish people run the New York Times.
I mean, again, like, this plays into this trope about Jews controlling the media, and we also know the myths of Jews controlling Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, you name it. Anti-Semitism is a conspiracy theory, and it adapts and it morphs and it shapes to the times and to the particular, you know, pathologies of the person pushing out the prejudice. That's what we have here. The bottom line is, all of these myths, again, have been used to justify violence against the Jewish people. And the people who push out such myths, Jake, they aren't our friends, right? They don't align with our values. When I say our friends, I mean they don't align with the American values of decency and humanism and tolerance. And that's why they're so problematic.
Yeah. Jonathan Greenblatt, thank you so much. Good to see you again.
So I don't know what he was thinking. Excuse me.
I would say this. I mean, so the quote of what he said, there are people in this country that are Jewish that no longer love Israel. I'll tell you, the evangelical Christians love Israel more than Jews in this country. And then he said somewhere else. Then he said, quote, the Jewish people in the United States either don't like Israel, don't care about Israel. And I will say this. There are plenty of Jews that I know that say that about other Jews in this country. They feel frustrated with the Jewish community that because they don't make Israel a priority in looking at candidates and different things. And that frustrates a lot of Americans.
Okay,
Jews.
I'm one of those. Laureen, I am one of those. Israel is...
No, wait.
I believe in Israel. I love Israel. It is not the number one issue who I
I'm
vote
for. I'm not talking about being a number one. Yeah, I'm not talking about being a number one.
But the domestic issues are much higher on my priority. And I know
and
some people...
That's fine.
No, I know
but
some
people...
I know some people who are single-issue voters, whether it's on Israel or abortion or whatever, and they make up their mind, whatever candidate they think is better for Israel, they will vote for. But I don't think that's you can cast aspersions towards Jews who don't put that as number one.
I'm not saying single issues are number one. I mean, I will tell you, there are plenty of Jews that I hear that are very frustrated with other American Jews who they feel like don't care about Israel. And he surrounded himself with his primary advisors were Jewish. I could see Kushner making comments about that with his frustration with other American Jews. I could see Jared Kushner saying stuff like that. I could see Dana Friedman saying stuff like that around
but
the
did,
president.
Didn't you think what he said was anti-Semitic?
So that comment, I didn't think that was anti-Semitic. I actually think he probably heard that and probably repeated that because it's probably what he's hearing from his Jewish advisors around him, because there is some frustration amongst many Jews in this country about their fellow Jew when it comes to Israel. That kind of statement doesn't surprise me. I think it was shocking and surprising and stupid. Quite frankly, I just say it was stupid what he said about Israel controlling Congress. I think what he was trying to say, and since he never has a very tactful way of saying anything, is that the U.S. Congress used to unanimously support the U.S.-Israel relationship, that we supported our close ally and our friend, and that there's growing tensions regarding that support of our close ally and friend. Now, he didn't say it that articulately, and I think the way he said it was pretty stupid and very offensive and definitely sounds anti-Semitic and can be used as an anti-Semitic trope. And all it does is fuel the fire of that specific trope. And that was very alarming to me. That's like raise the red flag. Like, don't be so dumb and say something like that.
Yeah.
And so that was really concerning to me. But I think, but that goes to the next story on AIPAC this week, which I think is a really big, important story.
Okay, we're going to disagree on that. I think it is horrendous. Let's talk about what AIPAC did this week.
So AIPAC, AIPAC is going to become, so AIPAC, just so people know, is not, historically for the last 30 years, is not a PAC. The PAC of AIPAC is the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. But they have decided to actually launch a super PAC in a PAC to fund candidates that support the U.S.-Israel relationship. And I think, I understand why they're doing it, that D.C. is very different today than what it was 30 years ago. And there are many new organizations out there that are fundraising and supporting anti-Israel candidates, that are supporting candidates that support the destruction of the Jewish state. And I think that that it's really difficult to respond to that and to be very clear about, you know, rating candidates on where they stand in their views of the U.S.-Israel relationship and making that publicly known. I think because right now it's really not publicly known.
But okay, I covered an AIPAC conference, what was it, 2-3 years ago. You were there as well. And what the AIPAC officials told me, because I asked them about, you know, lobbying and money and all that, so they said, no. We're not like that. We want to hold Israel in a positive light and show what Israel does for the United States. But we're not conflating that with money that we raise for candidates, because we don't think that'd be a good idea. That's what they said 2 or 3 years ago to me, and now they're saying, well, we didn't really mean that. I think it's bad. I think that it will give Israel a bad name with some people, and I think it is a bad idea that there's a political action committee that is working that way with AIPAC. I think that will hurt AIPAC.
I don't know. I mean, yet to be told. I think that there is a lot of, you know, this is a very long time coming, but I think over the last several years and watching what's happening and watching sort of the money flowing from these organizations that you know, are very anti-Israel and how that's influencing politics, I think they felt very strongly that, you know, we had to look at a shift and do something different. So, you know, we'll see. We'll see in the next election cycle what it looks like. I mean, none of us have seen it yet, so it'll be interesting.
To see
what happens.
Well, personally, let me just, and this has nothing to do with AIPAC, I hate political action committees. Whenever I get a call soliciting for one cause or another, the first thing I ask them is, are you a political action committee? And when they go yes, I go, thank you, this conversation's over. I think political action committees, the money in politics really screws things up. And so I just have a negative feeling toward political action committees in toto. And then I hate to see AIPAC get involved in that. But
I hear you. We'll have to see how that works out.
Okay, here's a weird one. This is a real left turn. And I'm real sad about this. Jeff Garlin, you know who he is?
From
Curb. And he played the father on The Goldbergs, which is one of my favorite shows. I love that show. Well, he has been dropped from the cast because he supposedly used extremely sexist and foul language, and people complained. And he won't be in the last couple of shows they taped this year. And now there's a question of whether whether the show will be renewed next year for its 10th season. But I thought I think it's just a great show, and I thought he was funny. And an interesting story that I think is interesting is that my brother's synagogue in Chicago had Jeff Garland's brother as the executive director of the synagogue. He's no longer there, but then he brought his brother into the synagogue to sort of do a speech, a stand-up routine and all that. My brother said he was wonderful. He was hysterical, but he's not going to be hysterical on the Goldbergs anymore. So,
I mean, if he's engaging, I mean, people said it was emotionally abusive. If he's engaging that type of conduct, I mean, I'm glad they took action. I mean, I'm sad to hear it.
No, but I agree. You cannot allow, even if someone is a star and integral to the show, to use that kind of language, whether it's sexist or whether it's just complete foul language and all. It's, you know, we're living in a different society. And thankfully, listen, we have a great interview coming up with a guest that we've had on here before, Dusami Washington, who is trying to improve relationships with the African-American community and the Jewish community. He's a spectacular guy. Maureen did a great interview with him, and we will have that right after we take this break. This is The Third Opinion.
That interview is coming right up. We want you to participate in Third Opinion. We want to hear your comments and suggestions. And you can make them at our website, thirdopinionpodcast.com. There you can also learn more about our hosts and listen to podcasts you may have missed. That's thirdopinionpodcast.com. Let's get back to Third Opinion.
Welcome back to The Third Opinion on WKDW and the Third Opinion Podcast. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Lorraine Jaffe.
And we're having a day, aren't we, here? Let's talk about Dusami Washington. This is the first of a two-part interview, and he talks at the beginning about his book. So talk a little about this guy. He is really deep, you know?
So happy. So some of you may recall, we had Dusami Washington on about 2 years ago. He was talking about the Mizrahi Project that he worked on when he was with Christians United for Israel. He recently founded the Institute for Black Solidarity with Israel. He's also the author of Zionism and the Black Church, and feels very passionate, very strongly about the Black community's relationship with Israel. And so, you know, he sort of dissects in an extraordinary, I mean, he's an educator. He's so brilliant. And he sort of is able to dissect and walk us through the true threats of critical race theory, Marxism, you know, this whole social justice issues of you know, making critical ethnic studies and sort of this emphasis of, you know, making Jews like the ultra whites, like this ultra whiteness. And he sort of talks about it, breaks it down and explains it. And then also just explains the history of the Jewish world in America with the Black community, our bond, how strong that bond is, and building upon that. I mean, it was just, I could have talked to him for hours. I hope you all really enjoyed it.
Well, much of it, Lauren, has to do with heritage and legacy. And what I mean by that, whether we're talking about Israel and Africa, which we teach in our organization, that alliance actually started some 3,000 years ago when the Queen of Sheba visited Solomon in Jerusalem. Literally the only nation to do anything like that. That's one of the most unique stories in all of the Bible, where basically this Cushite queen basically stands in solidarity with Israel and the Jewish people, declares God's love for Israel, and this relationship is forged from, again, 3,000 years ago. Or whether here, the history, the legacy of people like Booker T. Washington and Julius Rosenwald in the early 1900s, those two come together. Julius Rosenwald, of course, of Sears Roebuck fame, a Jewish philanthropist and a person very active in his community there in Chicago, saw what was going on with the discrimination of the Black community. Booker T. Washington appealed to him about building schools throughout the segregated South for Black students to be able to study, and that relationship was forged. From that synergy came some 5,400 schools over a period of time. And then the next generation, Dr. King and Rabbi Joshua Heschel, who during the Civil Rights Movement, you have the Black and Jewish community coming together to destroy the Jim Crow system that was put in place after the Civil War. So our education is both the historical part of it also, but underscoring why that synergy has been so powerful and why it's powerful even right now. The Civil Rights Movement in the United States, which Dr. King said himself, in which you had the Jewish community disproportionately represented, right? He said himself, and I quote, "There's no other ethnic group more present in the Negro struggle for justice than the Jew." And so there's a reason why that synergy was there and why that relationship has been so powerful and positive, not just for the Black community or the Jewish community, but just for the world, defining what civil rights was, defining what human rights needed to be, even in a nation in which there's freedom, but there was discrimination against those in terms of their skin color, that type of thing, that kind of setting the tone, right? So our organization underscores that synergy. And in many different ways, one of our key initiatives is called the Peace Initiative, for example, Plan for Education, Advocacy, and Community Engagement. That's where the acronym comes from. And our organization, as we're doing, we recruit IBC ambassadors. And after times of study and travel, there's something we're launching here this spring, and I'll say more about the travel as I guess we get into it on today. They will be ambassadors in their cities that continue to connect the Black and Jewish community together to address whatever issues may be prevalent there to improve the lives of people on the ground using the model that has been successful from the days, again, of Dr. Booker T. Washington, Julius Rosenwald, or Dr. King and Joshua Heschel. And specifically, what those issues are would depend on where we are in the region. Our IPSI ambassadors will be from Florida, where you are, all the way to California. And they're going to be addressing what the community leaders there feel are the most important. Those things may be education. They may be maybe stopping violence or bringing attention or awareness. I'm on my way to Chicago tomorrow morning to be with Pastor Corey Brooks in South Chicago, who is doing a fund drive to build a community center in what one of the Chicago papers called the most dangerous block in all of the United States of America, on an O block, right? And Corey Brooks, I met him through the Jewish community, my Jewish friends there at the Solomon Center. Some of my friends would stand with us. That's how he and I were connected, because he's already connected to the Jewish community. They're already working together. I'm going to highlight what they're doing, and as a prelude to what our IPSI ambassadors will be doing when they're on the ground. Our IPSI ambassadors in Chicago, just for one example, will be working with people like Pastor Corey Brooks and the other parts of the Jewish community to bring awareness, to help raise funds. This is what we are doing, because that synergy is already there. IPSI is not creating it. We are highlighting it and just strengthening it.
Wow. I mean, you're doing some amazing things around the country today, which we're sort of at a very, I would say, dangerous point in the nation today with critical race theories and critical ethnic studies and sort of the impact of that and some of the nuances in it on the Black and Jewish communities. You recently did a panel interview for the organization CAMRA, who we have on as a regular guest. That's the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting and Analysis. And it was titled Anti-Racism and Anti-Semitism, True Justice and Uncomfortable Truths. And for, by the way, for those of you listening who are interested, you can actually listen to this entire interview. It's available on YouTube. But you sort of did a really amazing job breaking down sort of these theories of critical race theory as well as critical ethnic studies, and in particular looking at the California Ethnic Studies model curriculum, and sort of explaining how it's so nuanced, but at the end of the day, sort of this definition of Judaism and Jews as a form of hyper-whiteness. Mm-hmm. Yes. And that's frightening to me. You know, Mike and I have talked about on the show, and I'm sure you've seen, you know, some school curriculums where they're teaching, you know, where they're comparing Jews to colonial white settlers here in America and the Palestinians to the Native Americans, and they're teaching this to 10-year-old children, you know, which obviously establishes a foundation of anti-Semitism in these kids. You know, Can you help break this down? And you know, I'll give you the floor to sort of walk us through what critical ethics studies and critical social justice is, and why it is so dangerous to both the Black and the Jewish communities.
Sure. So let's and you're right. It's a lot. It's broad. And it's funny. I remember a couple of years ago, Dennis Prager did a video and he was saying that he was so right that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is complex and it's easy. Right. The easy part is that there's one Jewish state and Israel's enemies don't want there to be a Jewish state. Period.
Right.
But the complex that part is easy. Right. The complexity is who the PLO is, who Hamas is, the United Nations, etc. All these things that have convoluted what is a very basic principle. Right. This is very similar when you come to things like critical race theory, which was an actual theory put forth by an academician, Derek Bell. Back in the, after the Brown versus Board education decision about segregated schools, Derek Bell was critical of the decision in terms of how this was going to be implemented, what you were going to do in an America in which it was clear that there were two-tiered system of education, right? There was white schools and there were schools that if they were segregated, schools that Black kids could not go to, that whole issue of denying access to somebody based on their race, creed, color, those types of things, right, which is an anathema to the Constitution. But again, for the listeners, as I tell, we often talk about our organization, the civil rights movement, the point of it was to dismantle the Jim Crow system that was superimposed on the Constitution, right? It was not to destroy the Constitution. It was actually to clarify, and like Dr. King said, as he stood there in Washington, D.C. at the March on Washington, right? He quotes from the Constitution, says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal and are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, those of, you know, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness," right? He's actually underscoring what the founding fathers are saying, though those words did not apply to Black slaves. He was saying, here, we're having to correct this historic injustice, right? So I've said all that for a reason. Critical race theory and some of these other things that you mentioned, critical ethnic studies, they purport to then do what we're saying, to make things equal in terms of access, that type of thing. But the problem is that the way that they are implemented and the way that they are often articulated, it's actually, unfortunately, this reverse racism. Let's bash white people. Let's bash European settler colonial, which is right. Everything that's in terms of its oppression needs to be condemned. But the problem, ladies and gentlemen, is that oppression is not a color. It's an actual principle. And once you begin to generally speak about an ethnic group of people or about a religious group of people in a whole swath, saying like all Christians are racist, all Muslims are terrorists. When you start to do Jews are and fill in the blank with something negative, right? Judaism is, first of all, it's intellectually dishonest. You cannot categorize a group of people like that, especially if you're going to attribute negative attributes to them. But secondly, it's very, very dangerous. Because what it does, it over a period of time, it's an indoctrination that focuses those young minds on those people or representatives of those people as being bad, evil, whatever have you, right? So this is, and you know, let me back up and say this. Often within the whole pro-Israel space, and I have friends and colleagues from across the spectrum, Lorraine, they're, you know, conservative, liberal, religious, secular, you name it, right? What I found all the time is that for those who get caught up in the whole anti-white people, or the old white male, you know, heterosexual Christians are the terrorists, blah, 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 blah. The reason why that's dangerous is, first of all, in whole cloth, you've just basically dismissed a whole group of people. Secondly, that will always, always, history has shown us, it'll always come back on the Jewish people. It will come back particularly that once you begin to say you ascribe evil or evil intention to this group, anyone who's listening to this podcast now who understands anything about the persecution of the Jewish people, you know that at some point the blaming of all the ills of society funnels down to the Jewish people. The Jews have done this, and the Jews control this, and the Jews. So once you start to do the white people, white people, white people, just substitute that with Jew, And now you have the attack on Jewish people. And I've seen some of my friends get involved in that whole anti-white, oh, white people this, white people that. And I'm kind of watching them going, you know, this, give it about 5 seconds, it's going to turn on you, right? Because these people who are then rapidly supporting what you're saying, they're not going to make a differentiation. They're not going to say, well, Ashkenazi Jews aren't really white. They're blah, blah. See, this, that's how that whole thing becomes so silly in that sense, right? You're not fighting justice when you're just condemning whole groups of people. You're just kind of getting in the groupthink, right? So what you have to be able to do, we tell our young people all the time, you have to be able to identify the injustice, right? Clearly identify it, and then work to alleviate that, right? And not identify a ethnic group of people, right? I'll say this one last thing, and then we'll go a little bit further. I'm from California. We live in North Carolina now. I grew up, I was there from a little kid, and so everything from the immigration debate to just the complexity and the plurality of the Hispanic community itself, whether they're Mexican, whether they're Central American, whenever the whole immigration debate would take place, people who weren't aware of the complexities in the Hispanic community assumed for that community what they felt about whatever was being debated. And often both sides of the aisle would just characterize the Hispanic community. Right, whether they dismiss them as all these people are gangbangers, is that any other, or these people are poor, these people are, it's amazing because I had many friends from whether they are first, Lauren, I had friends who are of Mexican descent whose families had been in California before California was a state in the Union. So yeah, they had a perspective that went way further than the talking points, and I found that once people are whittled down to talking points, they've been dehumanized. And that's the first step into actually coming against them in a very, very nasty way. Last part, critical ethnic studies. Having been an educator myself, we ran a charter school. My wife taught in the public school system in Stockton, California. I can tell you that when it comes to history, often the history that's taught in schools is lacking in really telling broadly what's happening, right? Telling about or going further. And this is more of an indictment on our education system than it is on some sort of race thing that actually happens. But yes, stories don't get told, right? If you're going to tell, for example, the Civil War story, what's central to that story is the black regiment from Massachusetts that actually fought for their own freedom. And so if you exclude those types of things, you're excluding American history. But critical ethnic studies becomes a bashing of white people and then a bashing of Jews, right? Jews are privileged, as you said before. Jews are part of the whole colonial narrative, just like they stole the land from the Palestinians, yada, yada, yada. That's not education, that's indoctrination. That is what is now law for CSUs in California.
Yeah.
Fascinating interview, and he's got so much more to say, and we'll get to him on next week on part two. Just a fascinating guy, I think, Lorraine. Now, I've got to admit, you mentioned critical race theory. That still has my head spinning. I'm confused where people are worried about this, when in Florida, at least, it's not taught in the schools.
And he explains it. I mean, he explains that the problem with it and the way it's promoted is that they don't define racism, which allows them with any specificity. So when they begin to break it down to critical ethnic studies and different things and these social justice causes within it, Judaism then becomes a form of hyper whiteness. There's some pretty serious quotes that we talk about from Patrice Cullors, the founder of Black Lives Matters, and several other key members in the movement pushing critical race theory and sort of the intent of that and behind it. And it is very dangerous. And so he's such a great educator and very complex, but he also, if you want to watch, cause he talks about it in more detail, there is a YouTube 1 hour dialogue with him on YouTube that the organization Camera did, I want to say a few months ago, on critical race theory, and he sort of talks about it in much more detail, and it was probably the most insightful dialogue I've heard on it and why it was problematic. And hearing that from an African American, talking about it, it was very helpful.
But some people don't want, here's my problem with those who are railing about critical race theory. They don't want any negative news about white people suppressing black people's lives particularly when slavery was in effect. They think that that should be just washed aside, and I don't think you can do that.
Yeah.
So
no, I mean, look, slavery's taught in schools, and it should be, and anybody who says the opposite, I mean, that's wrong. But at the same time, you need to talk about the war. You need to talk about the Civil War. You need to talk about the most bloody war, that more Americans died in that war than all other wars combined. And these are people who died fighting to stop slavery. Like, these are white people who died fighting to stop slavery, who were slaughtered. They were
on one side, and that's nobody, true. Nobody, but on the other side,
on
there
the other
were people.
Side, no, look, wait. But right, on the other side, it's not. But it's again, I mean, that. But those things need to be taught, and you know, it's a very, you know, you need to hear about the abolitionists. You should hear about the black soldiers who fought for the Union. You know, you should hear about all those things. I think it's really important.
I think, yeah, everything ought to be out there. But there are some people on the extreme end of railing against critical race theory who don't want anything negative said about white people suppressing black people in our country. And we know
people suppress white people, black people suppress black people. I mean, we can talk about the genocides happening in Ethiopia right now.
Well,
you know,
yeah, but we need to talk about all of it. We need to talk about it.
Exactly.
We do.
Exactly.
Hey, here's another story that I thought was interesting this week. Israel is asking the United States to speed up the transfer of KC-46 refueling tankers so they can keep their jets in the air longer. These are amazing, amazing airplanes. I had the opportunity years ago to go on a refueling mission with them out of MacDill, and which is located here in Tampa. And this is the coolest thing in the world. They're really a traveling gas station. And when I went on this mission, they're flying along at I don't know how many thousand feet we were. And all of a sudden, there were like five F-16s adjacent to the plane. We're all flying together. And then they moved in order underneath the tanker, which drops the hose, the gas hose, into the jet. And we were close enough where I could see the face of the pilot of the F-16. But the important thing for this, it protects Israel by allowing them to keep their fighter jets up and look for any intruders that come into Israel.
Well, my concern was, especially given the front page of the Tehran Times this week, is that the Biden administration apparently has rejected Israel's request to expedite the delivery of those two refueling jets, which is a little alarming. I mean, if I were Israel going, you know, if Iran decides to do that, we need to be able to get our jets up to, like, defend and protect. And
yeah, I don't know why they did it, because they're going to give them going to give them the jets. I don't understand that, but I understand why Israel wants that. But it's they're really amazing. It's an amazing piece of technology, and I hope that they get those soon, because they truly do need to get that. And again, this is to protect themselves, not to be aggressive.
Right. So can I have two interesting stories this week. The first, so I just had to go back to this Miss Universe, because there is an Arab reporter, Abdel Hamid Abdel Jaber. He's a columnist for the London-based daily Al-Quds Al-Arabiya. He also is a teacher, a professor at Rutgers University on Middle East studies. Well, he decided to, you know, while the event was happening in Eilat, he asserted that the Israeli occupation forces are not only confiscating Palestinian land, bulldozing their homes, expanding settlement activities, but they're also stealing their culture. He then, you know, went on attack against the Miss Universe contestants, you know, about them visiting Bedouins and in essence, accused them of stealing
the clothing,
stealing clothing and misappropriating Palestinian culture while the Miss Universe contestants were in Israel, and you know, that they stole Palestinian border dresses and appeared as if they are, you know, now wanting, you know, demanding answers, you know, from these women. I mean, I can't even understand, like, which is just an outright lie. Like, I don't, like, why would you even, like, it was such a stupid thing to say. Like you're just making stuff up again about, I mean, I guess he was just mad that Miss Universe happened in Israel and it was showcasing Israel in a positive light. So then he accuses these women of, like, stealing, misappropriating Palestinian culture and stealing Palestinian clothes and dresses and like, I'm like, all right.
You know what I don't understand, Laureen, and it happens in all forms of journalism these days, and it's not the majority, but there are a certain percentage of journalists who, when they have a position, they just write false narratives, ask false questions, and tell lies. It's across all ends of the political spectrum, and they make stuff up. It pains me. I spent 50 years of my career in journalism, and I truly am passionate about it, but you cannot take one side or the other. You've got to report the facts. It's like an umpire. You're calling balls and strikes, and you're not putting your foot on the scale to tip it one way or the other. And there is a percentage of journalists that do that. And yeah, I know. Yeah. I really shouldn't call them journalists. They're not journalists. They're propaganda. No, they're propagandists.
Propagandists. No, it's true. So let's boldly go where no man's ever gone before.
Right.
here's the William Shatner piece. So, so Jeff Bezos, and you know, he wants to go to space too, just like Elon Musk does, and everything else. And he's got grandiose plans. Apparently, he's been infatuated with going to space his whole life, and is. Yeah, has his own space program that he's working on. So he invited William Shatner of Star Trek fame to go on one of the voyages to space. And these are quick trips. You go up, you break the barrier, and then you come back down. And so there's actually on Amazon Prime, of course, because, you know, it's Jeff Bezos. On Amazon Prime, you can watch Shatner in Space. Which documents William Shatner's experience on the rocket going to space and, you know, working with Jeff Bezos. And you learn a little bit about Jeff Bezos. I mean, his desire really to deal with the environmental pollution, to take industries that cause pollution, to be able to do those in space and then bring the products back to Earth. I mean, that sort of was his vision as a child. And so he's working on that today. So very interesting. I started watching it last night. I was too tired to watch the whole thing, but it was definitely interesting. And how about the other movie that's coming out for Good and Welfare, Dr. Ruth?
Yeah,
the Dr. Ruth piece. So there's so folks, there is a new one woman show.
Tova Felchu.
Tova Felchu. She's and it's called Becoming Dr. Ruth. And you know, she just looks adorable in this photo. This piece ran in the Times of Israel. So she's going to be doing like a one-woman show, in essence, based on Dr. Ruth, which I've gotten rave reviews, and I can't wait. I hope I have a chance to see it. I mean, I just think this is so adorable. It's going to be in New York,
of course.
Well,
Dr. Ruth was so adorable. I mean,
oh God, she's the cutest thing in the whole world. I mean, she was hilarious. It's like, how can you not love Dr. Ruth? I mean, yeah. I mean, it's just like, you know, she was so cute. So that was like an adorable Good and Welfare story. I love that story. That was just really cute. So
okay. We're almost out of time, but I one other thing I want to mention, we ought to think about it, maybe talk more. See the article about young Jewish kids hiding their identity because they're concerned about anti-Semitism. That is really... That is upsetting. I think we need to explore that more. Maybe even find someone we can do an interview with. But I find
I find
that very upsetting. I just want to throw that out there. But we'll have to save that for another time because you know what that music means. We're out of time.
Yes.
That's right. Thank you for being with us. We're available wherever your podcasts are out there, and also on WKDW. And this is The Third Opinion. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Laureen Jaffe.
Bye.
That's our podcast this week. Don't forget to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Until next week, thanks for listening.